Let me get my stopwatch because I am time conscious. I will not begin this paper where I planned to, which was a discussion of the meaning of discrimination, because Dr. Williams has fortunately made that unnecessary. So I will plunge in medias res. We are not considering, I take it, the problems of the coexistence of members of different races in the abstract. For the problem to be significant, two conditions are necessary. First, the dominant race must regard the subordinate one as alien or unassimilable. Second, the subordinate race must be numerous or powerful enough to constitute a problem. Thus, discrimination against American Indians is not a major problem for white America because the Indians are quantitatively unimportant. Americans of Japanese and Chinese extraction constitute no problem, either in Hawaii or elsewhere, nor do they face much invidious discrimination, primarily because they've made an extraordinarily successful adaptation to American life and American mores and institutions, and because they've contributed far more than their share to the American creative elite. The case of a Negro is otherwise. From the inauguration of President Washington in 1799 to the New Deal, there was an American consensus concerning the Negro. This is a point that Professor William Marina and I hope to show in our forthcoming American Statesman and Slavery and the Negro, and I will not plug it a second time, which will probably be January 1971. We argue that the conventional view of irrepressible conflict between the slavocratic ideology of Calhoun and the egalitarian visions of the abolitionists does violence to American history. We consider both these positions, minority opinion made dominant briefly by the dialectic of clashing fanaticisms. The broad consensus opinion of both leaders and people was to oppose both the institution of slavery and the presence of the Negro. The conviction that the Negro was unassimilable and should not be granted citizenship was almost universal. The African slave trade was detested because it brought more blacks into the United States. The free Negro was harshly persecuted to drive him out of the communities where he attempted to settle. Such statesmen as Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Henry Clay, and Abraham Lincoln, to name only a few, urged that the Negro be emancipated and simultaneously deported. "We have the wolf by the ears," Jefferson declared, "and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is in one scale and self-preservation in the other." In his autobiography, he wrote, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free, nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government." In an address to a colored delegation to the White House in August 14, 1862, Abraham Lincoln urged that they take the leadership in colonizing the entire American Negro population in Panama. "I think your race suffers very greatly, many of them, by living among us, while ours suffers from your presence," he said. While the aspiration of men is to enjoy equality with the best, in the United States, not a single man of your race is made the equal of a single man of ours. He would not discuss this and could not change it, even if he so desired. "But for your race among us," Lincoln added, "there could not be war, although many men engaged in both sides do not care for you one way or another." The Emancipation Proclamation made colonization, the allopatric solution to the race problem, chimeric. Spatial separation being ruled out, postbellum America maintained subordination of the Negro and the strict regulation and minimization of interracial contacts through the Jim Crow system. This barred a whole matrix of relations, deprived the Negro of basic constitutional rights, and punished sexual contacts which threatened the ethnic integrity of the ruling race by terror and lynching. Unlike slavery, this new de facto system of segregation and subordination was administered not by the patrician South, but by the masses. Where slavery had involved responsibility on the part of the master and paternalistic concern for the welfare of the slave, the new system entailed no responsibility and total unconcern. The old way was predicated in noblesse oblige, the new way in animosity. The leading intellectuals and American statesmen of the first century and a half of the Republic deplored the Negro's presence and deprecated his ability. Among others, Jefferson, Madison, and Lincoln believed Negroes to be mentally and morally inferior to whites. The abolitionists held similar views. Thus, Charles Sumner called them moving masses of flesh, unendowed with anything of intelligence above the brutes. Thaddeus Stevens thought those he knew not qualified to vote. Ralph Waldo Emerson believed them degraded because of sin. William H. Seward found them a foreign and feeble element incapable of assimilation. Theodore Roosevelt voiced the judgment that, as a race and in the main, they are altogether inferior to the whites. Taft thought them destined to be a race of farmers first, last, and all the time. Woodrow Wilson believed they were childlike and had been better off under slavery. The labor historian John R. Commons sought the Negro to be indolent and fickle, and Charles Francis Adams, after visiting sub-Saharan Africa, urged that a free society must consist of homogeneous equals and must therefore exclude the Negro. To descend to the gutter movements of proletarian discontent, the American Socialist Party, during the only period when it was a mass movement, urged a racially segregated socialist America and officially termed the Negroes lynchable human degenerates. After the brief optimistic era of Reconstruction, disillusion with the emancipated Negroes' political and economic performance became widespread. The general negation of racial equality rights that followed has been attributed by liberal historians to such factors as an evil conspiracy by Southern Bourbons, disgust at the Negro's readiness to sell his vote, and the benighted character of Southern poor whites. Without wholly repudiating any of these suggested causes, I should like to suggest that a more fundamental one is embedded in the definition of the nation. Nation is defined in the Oxford English Dictionary, which I think is the ultimate authority on English literary and scholarly speech, as an extensive aggregate of persons so closely associated with each other by common descent, language, or history as to form a distinct race or people, usually organized as a separate political state and occupying a definite territory, unquote. The root of nation is nashi, meaning to be born, thus indicating the key role of lineage and nationality. The Negroes lack common descent with European settlers. Their history has little in common with that of England. The institutions of the Negro and Caucasian races are dissimilar. Even Negro speech is about as different from English as Catalan is from Spanish. The basic ingredients of common nationality appear lacking. Historically, have widely different races successfully coexisted on the basis of full and equal citizenship in a free society? I believe the answer is seldom, if ever. Multiracial societies normally rest in subordination. An extreme case is India, where the word for caste, varna, means color. Over the centuries, the proliferation of occupational taboos has clouded the underlying situation, but the foundation of the system, as C.D. Darlington urges, was the desire of the conquering Aryan element to bar miscegenation and regulate contact with the subjected indigenous peoples of India. Religions and priesthoods have historically played a major role in keeping races and sub-races apart. Priesthoods devise and enforce breeding barriers. Few people seriously believe today that the Jews were prohibited from eating pork and shellfish because of rabbinical insights about public health. The point was simply that people who can't eat together won't sleep together. If the priesthoods prohibited a great deal of outmarriage, they also imposed taboos and excessive endogamy, as the history of the Catholic churches in the Middle Ages, of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, so abundantly illustrates. Ethnic separation has often been efficaciously imposed even in the absence of priesthoods. The Gypsy separation from European society is an example. In Islam, which has no true priesthood, acceptance of slave girls in the harems tended to break down racial patterns among the upper classes. But a powerful countervailing force was the very widespread castration of Negro slaves. In Berber society, the solution arrived at was a white ruling class, a black slave class, and an intermediate class created by hybridization between the two. Examples of variant solutions could be indefinitely proliferated. The general rule is that the conquering ethnic element either exterminates the conquered or subordinates. In the second instance, the subordinate element is prohibited from interracial breeding of the sort that might affect the racial purity of the dominant element. This is a guarding of the women of the dominant race, not of the men, of course. It is excluded from specific high-status occupations and other interracial contacts are minutely regulated. Tribal genocide and expulsion of European and Asian minorities from some of the newly hatched African states suggests the fragility of tendencies toward super-tribal, let alone super-racial, nationality. An area in which the multiracial nation seems viable is Latin America. Here, however, the social structure is tacitly based to a significant degree on the subordination of the Indian and Negro races and on a complex gradation of ethnic status. I've alluded to some of these historic aspects of the problem in the belief that conservatives should be concerned with men and society as they are, rather than with natural rights concepts of what they should be. The conservative should dream, but his dream should be predicated in reality. In such places as Suriname, attempts to create multiracial states have led to a party system in which the parties are ethnic and often centrifugal to such an extent that their ultimate program involves destroying the national foundation. The racial bond is often regarded by its members as primary, the national bond as secondary. The total refusal of Palestinian Arabs to accept the state of Israel, even though self-interest dictates that they do so, is a tragic instance of this. In the United States, the record now stretches over two centuries, almost exactly bisected by a civil war that many thought would reduce racial strife to inconsequential dimensions. The fact of the matter is that after an historically unprecedented effort by the white majority to raise the Negroes to its level, one spanning a generation and costing tens of billions of dollars, the conflict seems more irreconcilable than at any time in our history. The more the Negro is offered not merely equality but preferential treatment, the more virulent seems to be his discontent. To the amazement of the liberals, articulate Negro spokesmen have become increasingly violent and committed to the destruction of a society which has offered their race more material well-being and educational and promotional opportunities than they have ever enjoyed anywhere else on earth. The more the Negro is advanced by hothouse treatment and governmental favoritism, the more he seems to reject the community of American nationhood in favor of that of racist negritude. Are there any sound biological reasons for the perseverance of race as one of man's most fundamental building blocks, as a community which successfully claims the allegiance of its members, even where self-interest and indoctrination point in opposite directions? I believe there are. Left-wing academic propagandists such as Gunnar Myrdal have popularized the belief that mutual avoidance by different races is prejudice, and that this prejudice has no basis in reality, but is merely evidence of the psychopathology of those afflicted by it. In the animal kingdom, the integrity of species and races is maintained by breeding barriers. Whether the races be allopatric or sympatric, these breeding barriers are both physical and psychic. Thus, a lion can be cajoled into mating with a tiger if no lioness is around, but he will do so listlessly. Ligers and tions, as these particular hybrids are called, depending on whether the speciation of the male, of course, whether it's a liger or a tion. They require for their creation either an absence of conspecific mates or an artificially created laboratory environment. The biological reason for this is the necessity for preserving stability in species as a successful adaptation to eco-niche, that is, ecological niche, and habitat, and in race as subspecies or emergent species. The forces for variation must be free to operate in evolution, but so much the forces for integrity of species. Otherwise, evolutionary variation would be mere chaotic change. This, I think, has been well adumbrated in Ernst Mayr's book, Animal Evolution. In man, a variety of obvious breeding barriers between races exist, such as differences in the size of genitals and body odor. Thus, prostitutes in Japan used to be medically classified into those who could have intercourse with Caucasian males safely and those who could not. Another example is the racial survival of the pygmies, which has been attributed by anthropologists to the fact that their body scent is acutely repugnant to the noses of all their neighbors. The most potent psychic interracial breeding barrier is that the man or woman with a healthy psyche tends to have strong self-love and self-esteem. Desiring to produce progeny in his own image, he generally chooses a mate resembling him physically, emotionally, and mentally. The adage that aging married couples grow to look like each other is a misreading of this. Actually, the spouse selection was probably based on original similarity, and as people age, their secondary sexual characteristics become less and less visible. If this analogy with the rest of the animal kingdom has merit, then the desire of races and sub-races to form enclaves or communities of their own is entirely natural. Its reproductive implications are obviously related to that self-love, which is a precondition of a strong ego and of mental health. The preference for a community of people of similar physical appearance, background, tradition, mores, emotional reactions, habits of thought, and convictions is also understandable. Liberals may consider the fact that many Italo-Americans live in Little Italy's, many Jews in golden ghettos, and many Chinese in Chinatowns, as evidence that ours is a depraved racist society. Sociologists, whose arrogance is sometimes matched only by their ignorance, should recall that the cities of most ancient civilizations were similarly stratified into the voluntarily separate districts of their component ethnic, national, and religious population. Many liberals and most socialists, fascists, and communists are attracted by John Locke's notion of the mind as tabula rasa, an empty slate in which the hand of authority can write whatever it pleases. Mankind is held to be a homogeneous substance. The unique importance of the human individual is considered a fallacy inherited from the ages of religious faith. The manifold differentiations of mankind into races, classes, and linguistic affiliations, the gradations of status, descent, aptitude, interest, and talent are deemed relics of a parochial attitude. To the conservative, however, human individuality and the diversity and complex articulation of the social order give life much of its flavor. Someone once said that those who refuse to learn from history must re-experience it. That is true. It is also true that one cannot copy the solutions of history, for the past is not the present, nor the present the future. In the present era of accelerating change in all parameters and aspects of human relations, slavish imitation of past solutions is particularly inappropriate. The problem of Negro-white co-nationality would have been difficult under any circumstances because of race difference and because of the bitter heritage of slavery. The additional factor which makes the problem virtually insoluble is the persistence of massive differences in the observed intelligence of the two races. I know it is fashionable in some circles today to downgrade both intelligence and intelligence test scores. The latter are a reasonably accurate measure of one's ability to grasp and solve the problems posed by science, the professions, administration, and all the command and semi-command echelons of modern society. To say that the tests measure ability to function in the bourgeois world is rather absurd. They are tests which Aristotle, Burke, and Lenin would all have passed with flying colors. They are, in short, about as good predictors as we have of the capacity to do the mental work essential to every civilization which relies on rational thought, whether that civilization be monarchist, free enterprise, socialist, fascist, communist, or what have you. Some sociologists have made the point that ghetto dwellers would probably do much better than white middle-class students in a test adapted to survival in their environment. That is true, but is also meaningless. In the Nazi and Soviet concentration camps, the common criminals survived, where some of the outstanding minds and noblest spirits perished. Do we live in a world so devoid of moral values that we equate the ability of the unknown thief who stole the bread and Frank need to survive with the author of the diary? In short, a test adapted to survival in the asphalt jungles of New York or Washington would be a test of quickness with a knife. And this is a characteristic that is sometimes necessary for survival, but is not the measure of human value. Unfortunately, despite a spectacular improvement in his material standards, leisure, educational opportunities, and chances for advancement over the past 40 years, the Negro has not narrowed the intelligence gap separating him from the white population since the World War I period. In fact, Arthur Jensen, William Shockley, and more recently University of Georgia Professor Travis Osborne have presented evidence that the gap is widening. The most comprehensive and recent study available is the mental test scores of all males who enlisted or were inducted into the American Armed Services in 1968. Of the 2 million men who appeared for induction, 32% of the Negroes and 6.5% of the whites failed the mental tests. They fell into a group so low that they were deemed hopeless military material. Of the survivors, 59% of the Negroes, but only 18% of the whites, fell into group 4, which is mentally inferior. Thus, about 3/4 of the Negroes, as against about 1/5 of the whites, were in the subnormal to retarded categories. Over 42% of the whites passing the mental test, but only about 7% of the Negroes passing it, were in groups 1 and 2, very superior and superior. There were proportionally about 20 times as many whites as Negroes in the group 1 category, and this is by no means a genius measure. It is not even nearly good enough to get into Mensa. Compare these results to those for the past decade, if you prefer, with the World 1 comparative Negro and white scores, and it becomes probable that the Negroes have actually lost ground in relation to the whites in respect to psychometric intelligence. I do not wish to discuss here whether this difference is genetic or environmental in origin. The practical point of importance is that since a generation of Herculean public and private effort to raise the Negro status has done nothing to lessen the gap, we can assume that it's going to remain with us and going to continue to be central to the problem of race relations in the United States. I should like to turn now to the question of policy, of what should be done. If the option were open, few white Americans would today wish to open our gates to the 20 million Negroes now in the country. But this has occurred. Obviously, colonization and imposed subordination by law must be ruled out. The Negroes are American citizens. There is no room in our system for subcategories of citizens with inferior rights. One approach is that represented by the ultra-liberal ideology in race. It presupposes that race differences are superficial and that no innate mental differences of consequence exist. To combat prejudice, governmental action is urged to compel interracial association regardless of the wishes of either ethnic group. White and black children are forced to mix in the same schools and live in the same neighborhoods. On the theory that any superior position enjoyed by the whites is due to prejudice and unfair advantage, governmental action of a compensatory sort is taken to bring the Negro up to the white level. This means denying scholarships, appointments, jobs, and promotions to the best qualified applicants if they happen to be white. To the extent that race quotas, rather than ability, determine promotion, American science, technology, medicine, the professions, government, and business leadership must suffer. In education, the stress is in hardship, not in ability. The best educational resources of a nation are squandered on mentally below average children of both races, whose potential is so low that they can contribute little or nothing to our society. The intelligent students, forced into the straitjacket of the slow motion educational system, find that the schools shackle their minds. Many acquire a profound antipathy to formal education, many become dropouts, still others develop revolutionary resentment. The gifted have become the orphans of American public education. The nation is engaged in squandering and stultifying its most promising human resources. If this were a deliberate effort to yield intellectual leadership to the communist world, no more suicidal course could have been devised. Let me add that in such fundamental matters, President Nixon represents no visible improvement over Johnson or Kennedy. The largesse of government jobs today goes to Republicans. All that remains unchanged is wrong-headed policies, which may destroy the nation. Some conservatives today advocate developing a parallel system of private education through the voucher system. Yet in defending it, such spokesmen for the conservative view as Bill Rusher vie with their liberal opponents in trying to show that it will mean more educational concentration on the disadvantaged. This is the tactic of expediency. Yet unless the real problem is faced, that of the educational disinheritance of those superior minds which form the leaven and hope of every society, then nothing is gained by such discussions. A second profoundly adverse consequence of our educational policy is alienation. The more the policies of race favoritism and enforced interracial association are applied, the more apparent and militant is Negro rejection of American society. When masses of academically and mentally unqualified blacks are pushed into the universities, they are humiliated by failure and angered by rejection. This creates a racist revolutionary element which demands the destruction of all academic standards and sometimes the destruction of the academy as well. When frustrated, it turns to mob violence, arson, terror, and murder. Negro alienation from American society has reached unprecedented proportions. This alienation is correlated with an increased association and competition between the two races forced upon them by doctrinaire bureaucrats. The suggested alternate policy is simple and consonant with the traditions and principles of American society. Government should continue to act to ensure that no citizen is denied his civil rights or access to public schools, public office, or any other governmental facility because of race. In private areas, individuals should have the right to associate or refuse to associate with anybody they please without interference by governmental authority. Racial mixing in the schools, neighborhoods, and residential complexes, according to bureaucratically prescribed formulas, is an abuse of governmental power. It is the business of the state to see that people are not deprived of their rights because of their race. It is not the business of the state to prescribe how they should be mixed in relation to their race. Favoritism in governmental appointment, promotion, scholarship, or entry into any educational institution on the basis of race is a violation of the 14th Amendment. It should be outlawed. Any compensatory advantages given Americans because of an unfavorable economic, social, or educational environment should apply to all persons so handicapped, and not merely to those racially so handicapped. Government should endeavor to enforce equality of rights and equality of opportunity. It should not try to legislate equality of rewards. In our society, rewards are supposed to be proportionate to contributions. Those who achieve more should receive more. These suggestions presuppose a return to those traditional values of an open and free society, which were once such a vital element in the American dream. Contemporary government policies involving racial quotas and official ethnic discrimination are more reminiscent of Tsarist Russia, Nazi Germany, and the Soviet Union than of the free world. As Theodore Roosevelt, an unjustly neglected spokesman of American conservatism, put the matter in 1901, I have not been able to think out any solution to the terrible problem offered by the presence of the Negro on this continent, but of one thing I am sure, and that is that inasmuch as he is here and can neither be killed nor driven away, the only wise and honorable and Christian thing to do is treat each black man and each white man strictly on his merits as a man, giving him no more and no less than he shows himself worthy to have. Thank you.